I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, former Deputy Secretary of State William J. Burns talks about the shape of American diplomacy today and why a diminished State Department bodes poorly for the U.S. and for the stability of the broader world. Burns testified last month before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee about the critical need to partner with traditional European allies to manage the rise of China and to conduct a long game in dealing with Russia, as it exists in the present moment and as it might be in the era after Vladimir Putin. We'll talk about Burns' assessment of President Trump's foreign policy strategy and about the dangers of overestimating the importance of the president's personal relationships with the leaders of international adversaries. Our conversation starts after a short break. Former Deputy Secretary of State William J. Burns has a favorite memory of American diplomacy in action. President George H.W. Bush sits at the head of a conference table in Madrid with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev next to him, and Arab, Israeli, and Palestinian leaders in the other seats around the table. You have to understand, it was unprecedented to have all those parties physically in the same room willing to talk about peace. They didn't show up because they necessarily thought they could reach an agreement. They were there because the American president had summoned them. And in the immediate aftermath of the peaceful end of the Cold War, the United States was the undisputed leader of the world. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Ambassador Burns recalls that moment as the high point of American power and of our embrace of statecraft over military aggression. It was a triumphant time indeed, but it was almost 30 years ago. And today, Burns worries that the State Department and, by extension, American influence have been weakened by decades of strategic and operational drift, and now by a president who underestimates the complexities of international relations and overestimates the values of his personal relationships to adversarial leaders like Kim Jong-un and Vladimir Putin. Ambassador William J. Burns retired from the Foreign Service in 2014 following a career in which he also served as U.S. Ambassador to Jordan and Russia. Today, he is president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he's written a book called The Back Channel, a memoir of American diplomacy and the case for its renewal. Bill, welcome to Think.
Chris, it's great to be with you. Thanks so much for having me.
If you witnessed something like the apex of American influence in the early 90s, what went wrong after that?
Well, I think part of it was the natural order of things. You know, at the end of the Cold War, the United States really stood as the singular dominant player on the international landscape. And over time, it was inevitable that other powers like China were going to rise. You'd see a resurgence of Russia. And that's just a reality that we need to adjust to. Now, the truth is we accelerated that movement with some unforced errors of our own, like the war in Iraq in 2003, the great financial crisis, which was, you know, in a way, another demonstration of a different kind of American hubris. But we're left with a situation where, in my view at least, we still have a better hand to play than any of our rivals in the world if we play it wisely. And that's really the question before us.
What are our remaining strengths? We have a big economy. We have a big military. What else would you point to?
We do. It's the military and the strength and resilience of our economy today. I mean, you don't get very far in diplomacy unless it's backed up by military and economic strength. I think in better times, the power of our example. I've always found when I've served overseas that Americans get further with the power of our example than we do with the power of our preaching. Now, that's suffered in recent years, you know, through polarization and dysfunction in our own society. But another big advantage, I think, for the United States on today's landscape is our ability to invest in alliances, our capacity for coalition building, which really does set us apart from lonelier powers like China and Russia. And that's where diplomacy becomes really important, because that really ought to be our tool of first resort for taking advantage of those, you know, really important assets.
So you were U.S. ambassador to Russia starting in 2005, which means Vladimir Putin was the leader to whom you presented your credentials. And I gather you had a pretty unforgettable meeting with him.
I did. I'll vividly remember the first meeting I had with Vladimir Putin as the newly arrived American ambassador in Russia. There's this initial meeting in which you present your credentials, the letter from the American president to pass to the president of Russia, and that begins your tenure as ambassador. So this takes place in the Kremlin. which is built on a scale that's meant to intimidate visitors, and especially newly arrived ambassadors. You walk through these huge halls and down long corridors, and finally at the end of one hall, you can come up against a two-story set of bronze doors, and you're kept waiting there for a minute, which is mostly to, you know, let you digest everything around you. And then the door cracks open a little bit, and out walks Vladimir Putin. Now, Putin, despite his bare-chested persona, is not particularly intimidating in physical stature. He's probably about 5'6", although he carries himself with a lot of self-assurance. And so he comes walking through the door. Before I handed him my letter, before I got a word out of my mouth, President Putin looks me square in the eye and says, "You Americans need to listen more. You can't have everything your own way anymore. We can have effective relations, but not just on your terms." And that was vintage Putin. It was not subtle. He had a set of grievances and a large chip on his shoulder, and he was defiantly charmless. But that's the Putin and Putin's Russia, you know, with which successive administrations have struggled to deal.
Could Putin have been anything but a corrupt leader, one who certainly is bombastic in relationships with the rest of the world, but has not necessarily always had the best interests of his own people at heart?
You know, I think by professional training, you know, as a former KGB officer, by dint of his own, you know, difficult upbringing, he grew up kind of on the other side of the tracks in Leningrad in the Soviet Union from a family that, you know, was relatively poor. He grew up in, you know, urban schoolyards where, as he once put it publicly, the weak get beat. And so he had a worldview, you know, long before he became the president of Russia, which was built in a sense around mistrust of people around him, of suspicion. So, you know, I don't think it's inevitable that he turned into, you know, the very pugnacious leader who, you know, has seen, you know, the road to expanding Russia's influence in the world as chipping away at an American-led order. But I think there was bound to be, once Russia got back on its feet after, you know, the immediate post-Soviet period in the 90s, when it was literally flat on its back economically and politically, when the, you know, Red Army that during the Cold War was supposed to be able to get to the English Channel in 48 hours looked more like a street gang, albeit a nuclear-armed street gang. But you know, Putin, I think, developed a very combustible combination of grievance and ambition and insecurity. His sense that the West and the United States had taken advantage of Russia's moment of historical weakness. And so when he, by the time I arrived as ambassador, he was surfing on $130 a barrel oil. You know, Russia's economy had bounced back. He was in a position to push back. And I've always seen Putin as an apostle of payback. You know, when he had an opportunity to get even, that's what he sought to do.
You've described Russia today as a declining but still potentially dangerous power. Does Vladimir Putin have a realistic understanding of Russia's position in the world at this moment?
You know, he's a realist, if not a cynic. And so he understands that he's playing a relatively weak hand compared to the United States, compared to a rising China. As he once put it publicly a year or so ago, though, he said, you know, it's not my fault if I play a weak hand strongly and people with stronger hands play them weakly. This was, I think, a comment on Syria and Russia's military intervention there. But I do think Russia, you know, by any objective measure, is a declining power in terms of its demography, a population that's declining or at best flat. The reality that, you know, if you look at the vast expanse of Russia across 11 time zones, you know, east of the Ural Mountains, across all of Siberia and the Russian Far East, there's only about 30 million Russians. And they're, you know, looking across a very long border at 1.4 billion Chinese and sitting on just about everything in the periodic table of elements. And so, you know, there's reason sometimes for Russians feeling insecure. I think one of the historic criticisms of Putin when people look back at his tenure as the leader of Russia is going to be, at that moment when hydrocarbon prices were so high, he had an opportunity to begin to diversify the Russian economy a little bit, because you got a very well-educated population that could compete in lots of areas beyond what comes out of the ground. And he chose not to do that because he believed it would come at the expense of political control, which is what mattered most to him. So, as I said, I think Russia is a declining power, but Putin demonstrates most every day that declining powers can be at least as disruptive as rising powers.
Looking at Russia's interference in the presidential elections in 2016, was Putin's aim to help Donald Trump win or to hurt Hillary Clinton's campaign, humiliate Hillary Clinton?
I think some of both. I mean, I think Putin, you know, who is an adroit counterpuncher, remember he was a, you know, studied judo, you mm-hmm. know, over most of his adult life. And so he understood the importance of building leverage against stronger opponents. And you build leverage by seeing their weaknesses. And in 2016, he saw, you know, a very polarized and in many ways dysfunctional American political system. And to him, that seemed to be an opportunity to reinforce the chaos, to sow a little bit more dissension, to expose what he always argues is the hypocrisy of democratic systems. In other words, they're just as corrupt as authoritarian systems. He wanted to put his thumb on the scale against Hillary Clinton because I think he expected, as I guess lots of Americans did, that she was going to be elected president. And he thought that she would be a formidable competitor. And this was an opportunity to hobble her a little bit. But he was also putting his thumb on the scale in the same way for President Trump. I don't believe that in his wildest imagination, Putin thought that his efforts were going to have as much impact as I think they did, nor did he expect that Donald Trump was going to get elected president. He was probably as surprised on election night as President Trump was.
What does he want from President Trump now?
You know, I don't think he may have, Putin may have had some initial illusions right after the election that he could work with the Trump administration to bring about the rapid ending of U.S. sanctions against Russia, the sanctions that were brought first over Russia's aggression against Ukraine in 2014 and then, you know, later over election interference. I think, you know, as I said, Putin's a realist. I think he understood pretty quickly that what sentiment in the Congress was, what sentiment, for that matter, was in most of the Trump administration, which was, you know, pretty tough, suitably tough with regard to Russia. So I think for Putin, next best thing, if you can't orchestrate the relaxation of sanctions, is an erratic American leadership in the world, which, as I was suggesting before, that's what Putin sees as creating space for Russia as a major power, a United States that, you know, is in many ways, I think, squandering assets like the transatlantic alliance that's pulling out of agreements and treaties around the world. That, in Putin's view, creates space for Russian power and for his influence.
The U.S. moved to pretty rapidly expand NATO at the end of the Cold War, which was very much a sore spot for Russia. Was that a mistake in terms of a policy decision?
You know, I think NATO's expansion, you know, after the end of the Cold War moved in several phases. In the initial phase in the mid and late 1990s, when Poland and a number of other Central European countries were admitted as, you know, formal members of NATO, I think it's fair to say that we, all of us in the U.S. government, underestimated, you know, how sharp the Russian reaction to that was ultimately going to be. But I have to say, I also understood, I was sitting in the embassy in Moscow during the first time I served there in the mid-90s at the time. And even sitting in that perch, you had to understand the sense of insecurity that Poles felt as well, you know, historically caught between the ambitions of Germans and Russians. And so there was a pretty strong argument to try to anchor Poland as one country, but other new members, you know, in a sense of security and possibility in the West. Where I do think we made, you know, a significant mistake was a decade later in the spring of 2008, at the end of the George W. Bush administration, when I think we left the whole issue of the expansion of NATO kind of on autopilot and pushed hard to open the doors to NATO membership for Ukraine and Georgia. It's very hard for any member of the Russian political elite, it's not just Vladimir Putin, to see themselves as a major power in the world without, you know, a significant and positive relationship with Ukraine. And so, you know, in that kind of insecure view, Ukraine moving into NATO was a pretty significant and almost existential threat. And That, I think, is not a justification for Putin's aggression in 2014, but it fed Putin's narrative that the United States is determined to keep Russia down and take advantage of their weaknesses. And so I do think that was a mistake.
Ambassador William J. Burns is president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, former deputy secretary of state. His book is The Back Channel, a memoir of American diplomacy and the case for its renewal. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Ambassador William J. Burns, former Deputy U.S. Secretary of State, now President of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His book is called The Back Channel, a memoir of American diplomacy and the case for its renewal. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Bill, when you testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee last month, you noted that Asia needs to remain the first priority of American foreign policy. To the extent that it seems inevitable that China's economy will grow larger than our own in time, how does that economic power translate to Chinese influence in the world?
Well, I mean, I think China, you know, aspires to be a global economic peer of the United States. I think Asia has increasingly become the center of gravity in the global economic system. And I think the issue here is, given the ways in which the American and Chinese economies are entangled today, ways that benefit us both, despite our concerns about predatory Chinese trade and investment practices, the issue is not so much, you know, how you contain China's political or economic rise, but how do you shape the environment into which it rises? In other words, how do you shape, you know, the alliances, the web of partnerships, the institutions across Asia that offer an affirmative view of what's the Asia that we want to see, an Asia in which China's rise is not going to come at the expense of everybody else's security and prosperity. I mean, that would have been the benefit of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the big trade agreement that President Obama had negotiated, which would have knit together 40% of the global economy across Asia. And I think that's the kind of thing, it's not a perfect trade agreement. I've never seen perfect on the menu of diplomacy or trade agreements. But I think we let the perfect be the enemy of the good, you know, when the Trump administration decided to pull out of that, because that's the kind of tool that really does shape the incentives and disincentives for China as its economy grows and as it considers reforms at home, which really would be in its own self-interest. But we can reinforce that by working with others who share our concerns, whether it's Japan or even the European Union outside of Asia, about Chinese practices. But instead, I think what we've done in the last couple of years is started second and third front trade conflicts over steel and aluminum and other issues with those countries who really ought to be our partners in pushing back against Chinese practices.
To the extent that a rising China poses any threat to the United States, is the hazard mostly economic? Is it military? Is it technological?
Well, I think it's all of the above, and I wouldn't underestimate the dangers of, you know, of military conflict in the sense that history is full of collisions between rising powers like China and established powers like the United States. There is a risk of that if we're honest with ourselves. I do not, however, think that that's inevitable or foreordained. I mean, that's really the challenge of statecraft and diplomacy. Is how do you work to manage great power relationships, manage the gray area between peace and war, bring to bear all the leverage that not only the United States has itself, but that we can, you know, maximize and multiply by working with allies and partners and institutions, you know, in ways which are going to help shape China's rise, not contain it, not force others in Asia to make choices between China and the United States. But I think we have a lot of levers with which we can help, you know, shape China's rise, avoid military conflict. And obviously in the realm of technology, this is going to be an intense competition. China is investing, you know, enormous sums and enormous energy in the development of artificial intelligence. The United States has significant advantages, I think, given the innovativeness of our own economy and of our society. But this is going to be a very serious competition.
So if we are to complete the pivot to Asia that President Obama talked about, what sort of role does that leave for our European allies? What can they do that we were doing previously?
Well, ironically, I think a greater focus on Asia and its significance actually makes the transatlantic alliance more rather than less important, in the sense that, you know, there's no group of allies with whom we have a greater sense of shared interests and values, even at this complicated moment when it seems like, you know, we're both having nervous breakdowns on either side of the Atlantic. There still is a, you know, greater sense of common purpose, whether it's in dealing with China's rise and trying to manage that in a healthy and stable way, dealing with the insecurities of the Middle East, which sadly I think are going to continue for some time to come, which lies just across the Mediterranean from Europe, and with the resurgent Russia that I think is going to be a complicated player to deal with for some time. So in terms of the balance, I think there's a logic as the United States spends relatively more of our attention and of our resources on Asia for our allies in Europe to take up more of the burden in dealing with security in Europe and stability there, as well as playing more of a role in doing what outsiders can do, and there are limits to that, to try to encourage some longer-term sense of order in the Middle East.
To the extent that our newly diminished dependence on imported oil has changed our need to be actively engaged in the Middle East, does it change our goals for the region?
I think the goals remain broadly the same, in the sense that we have an interest, the United States does, in a broad sense of order and stability in the Middle East. We have to recognize the limits of our ability to influence or to shape that. But I think what's important to do, you know, in the wake of, you know, what I think was a tragic experience in the Iraq War, is to begin to shift the terms of our engagement in the Middle East. So it's not as if we can neglect the Middle East. You know, the Middle East is a classic example of where the old Vegas rule doesn't apply. You know, the rule that what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. What happens in the Middle East doesn't stay in the Middle East. It spills over. Our European, you know, allies have faced that with the migration crisis and all the political consequences that that's produced across Europe. So we can't neglect the Middle East, but I think what we ought to do is focus less on military tools. They're still going to be important, but I think not to overemphasize them as we've sometimes done since the horrible shock of 9/11, and focus more on the range of other tools, especially diplomacy, to try to do what we can to cushion the risks and the fragilities.
I want to talk about North Korea for a minute. The recent summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un ended early and ended abruptly. Is there some good news out of North Korea that somehow we've overlooked?
Well, I mean, I suppose the good news is, I mean, A, there have not been for more than a year now either nuclear or long-range missile tests from North Korea. That's a good thing. You know, the fire and fury rhetoric of 2017 has clearly subsided. And I suppose another element of good news would be found in the disappointment of a failed summit in Hanoi a few weeks ago, in the sense that I think what that episode provided was a kind of dose of cold water on a lot of the inflated expectations about what's possible with North Korea. I think Kim Jong-un has made very clear that he has no intention in the foreseeable future of full denuclearization. I think he sees it as too important to his security, to his stature, to the survival of his regime. So the question, I think, really is, you know, what can be done, even if you preserve that as we should, as an aspirational goal, full denuclearization, what can be done to reduce the dangers in the meantime? And, you know, in one of life's great ironies, if you set aside the venom with which the Trump White House has viewed the Iran nuclear negotiations, if you could produce something like what we produced at the end of 2013, the interim nuclear deal with the Iranians. Now, granted, the two situations are not analogous. The Iranians didn't then and don't today have nuclear weapons. The North Koreans have dozens of them, and they're, you know, as we speak, expanding their capacity to make more. But what we did in that interim agreement at the end of 2013 was to freeze the Iranian program, roll it back in some significant respects, impose for the first time some really intrusive monitoring and verification processes so we could see if they were trying to cheat, all in return for very modest sanctions leverage. So we preserved most of the leverage for the later comprehensive talks. It's not a perfect solution, but it was a very positive step in dealing with the Iranian nuclear challenge. And something similar to that, I think, would be a way of reducing the dangers with North Korea. Now, the only thing I'd add is that that would require us refocusing on the kind of hard work of diplomacy, the day-in, day-out slog, and setting aside, you know, diplomatic love letters and triumphalist rhetoric, you know, that's not really tethered to history. So if we can do that, if we can recognize this as a dose of cold water, you know, there is an opportunity to reset our diplomatic approach.
So the president does seem confident that his warm personal relationship with Kim might be sufficient to convince him at some point to give up nuclear weapons to the extent that the U.S. wants it. How much, Bill, do such relationships matter between heads of state? And at what point do they cease to be important?
Well, they do matter. I mean, I would be the last person to argue otherwise. Again, if you think back to the experience that I mentioned at the beginning of my book in the George H.W. Bush administration, I mean, President Bush 41 understood as well as any president I ever served the significance of building personal relationships with allies as well as with rivals. And he worked at it even in moments when he didn't have anything to ask of another leader. It was just an investment in building a sense of personal trust. So those relationships do matter, but they're necessary but not sufficient. You know, what you have to couple that with, as George H.W. Bush, as Jim Baker demonstrated, you know, during their time in office, you have to couple that with a systematic approach that connects ends to means, that maximizes the leverage we have to bring to bear. And that's what can really produce diplomatic outcomes. What I fear in the current administration is you see just kind of an infatuation with personal relationships, especially with authoritarian leaders, in a kind of autocrat envy. And I think, you know, a lot of autocrats around the world, whether it's Kim Jong-un or Vladimir Putin, tend to view the president's efforts to ingratiate himself to them as signs of weakness and manipulability. So if it's not connected to the serious hard work of diplomacy, you're not generally going to get very far.
How do you tell a U.S. president, and we don't even have to speak specifically about President Trump here, that his instincts with regard to dealing with a particular leader seem likely to yield bad results? What are those conversations between the State Department and the president sound like?
Well, you know, they're not often career enhancing, so it's not, they're not easy conversations to have, which is why I've always respected, in particular, presidents and secretaries of state who, you know, maybe they weren't thrilled when people disagreed with them, but they welcomed a kind of honest debate about those issues. And they didn't mind people, you know, telling them when they thought that they had overstepped. That was certainly true in the first Bush administration. President Bush 43 was also, you know, open to those kind of conversations. And certainly you've seen it in recent years in President Obama as well. And I think that's, you know, diplomacy and statecraft in general are businesses of human interactions. And so you have to have those same kind of honest interactions inside the highest levels of the U.S. government, too.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Help me understand this about the Iran nuclear deal. The president and his allies have been celebrating that withdrawal from the deal, the JCPOA. State Department veterans that I've spoken to thus far, and I would include you in this, see that withdrawal as a tremendous mistake. How did this single deal that represented such a win to some experts turn out to be such a political liability?
Well, part of its controversy had to do with the nature of the U.S.-Iranian relationship over the last 35 years or more. You know, a huge amount of baggage on both sides, huge mistrust, a huge sense of grievances. And to be honest, I mean, I lived through some of those, so I understand. You know, when I watched my colleagues in the embassy in Beirut being killed in a, you know, embassy attack in the early 1980s, you know, you can understand, you know, why Americans are deeply suspicious of Iranians, and Iranians for that matter, you know, when they saw the United States sort of put its thumb on the scales with Saddam Hussein's Iraq against Iran and the war that those two countries had in the 1980s, you know, in some ways they've come by their suspicions and grievances honestly too. So you know, U.S.-Iranian relations have been a minefield for a long time, and nobody's had a really good map for getting through it. But I was, you know, convinced for a number of years by the time I got to senior jobs in the State Department that it was important to test at least the possibility that direct engagement, direct diplomacy might get you someplace better than the very risky track that we were on. And, you know, I always saw that kind of direct diplomacy not just as a test of Iranian intentions, but also as an investment in building lots of allies and partners. Because if the Iranians, when we engage them directly, as we did the end of the Bush 43 administration and the Obama administration, proved unwilling to meet us halfway, you know, then we could go to allies and partners and say, you know, if we're going to produce a serious negotiation, we're going to have to turn up the heat in terms of economic pressure and political isolation. And that's what we did. So, you know, diplomacy, a lot of times I think people think is just about talking nicely to people. It's not. I mean, it's a way of improving your leverage. And to make a long story short, you know, by the beginning of President Obama's second term, that kind of international pressure had produced a situation in which Iran's oil exports had dropped by 50%, the value of their currency had dropped by 50%. Their minds were focused. And when we made clear our willingness to engage them directly, as we did in the secret talks that I led with the Iranians through most of 2013, you know, they were prepared to deal more seriously. And we were able to make some diplomatic progress, which didn't solve, you know, the Iranian problem, because Iranians can threaten American interests and the interests of our friends in lots of different ways. But it did at least remove one layer of risk and one layer of fragility posed by an unconstrained Iranian nuclear program. So that's the backdrop to, you know, me saying that I think President Trump's decision to pull out of that agreement was an historic mistake, because I don't think that decision was based on a real interest in a better deal with Iran. I think it's based on a false assumption, the assumption that we can bring enough pressure to bear, mostly unilaterally, that's going to cause either the implosion or the capitulation of that regime. And I think that's untethered to history again. I just think it's a regime that is pretty good at several things. It's good at repressing its own people. It's good at muddling through. It's good at blaming outsiders like the United States for the contradictions, you know, of its own approach. And I fear that not only is this effort not going to produce anything other than a hardening of Iranian attitudes, at least in the short term, it's also going to have some collateral damage, because we're deepening the fissures between us and our closest European allies who want to hold to the deal, in a sense doing Putin's work for him. And over time, I think we're also eroding the utility of sanctions, because more and more countries are going to want to reduce their vulnerability to unilateral American sanctions. Even the foreign minister of Germany said publicly this past year that, you know, we all ought to reduce, you know, our exposure to the American financial system. So we ought to be paying attention to that.
My guest is Ambassador William J. Burns. We're talking about his new book, The Back Channel.
Support for Think comes from ArtCan, a program of the Texas Cultural Trust and Houston Endowment, whose 2019 State of the Arts report finds the arts contribute more than $5.5 billion annually to the Texas economy. More at artcantexas.org.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Ambassador William J. Burns, former Deputy United States Secretary of State, now President of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and author of the new book, The Back Channel, a memoir of American diplomacy and the case for its renewal. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Bill, how would you have counseled the president to respond publicly to the murder of Jamal Khashoggi?
I think that was a horrific act. I think our response should have been much sharper, both in public and in private. I think, you know, if you want to have healthy relationships with partners like Saudi Arabia, and, you know, we have been partners for a long time, you have to be honest, and that relationship has to be a two-way street. That was a horrific demonstration of overreach on the part of Mohammed bin Salman, the new crown prince and effective leader of Saudi Arabia. And I think we should have pushed back not only against him and those who I believe were responsible for that murder, which took place, after all, in a Saudi diplomatic facility in Turkey, but we also ought to have, in a sense, used that opportunity to push back against other kinds of Saudi overreach, in particular the war in Yemen, which has turned into a humanitarian catastrophe, you know, costing the lives of tens of thousands of Yemeni civilians, but also, I think, a strategic catastrophe. Where, you know, the behavior of Saudi Arabia and its partners in the midst of the Yemen civil war is actually just creating more opportunities for Iran, which isn't spending nearly as much as the Saudis are. And in a way, it, you know, it suits Iranian interests. So it just seems to me that, you know, our response ought to have been much sharper, both on moral grounds, but also on the practical grounds that I just mentioned.
You thought President Obama's response should have been sharper in Syria upon the use of chemical weapons?
I do. You know, I have enormous regard for President Obama, and I always understood the concern, born in a sense of the experience in Iraq a decade before, of not going down a slippery slope toward another large-scale military intervention. I did, however, think that in the instance of, you know, the large-scale use by the Assad regime of chemical weapons against its own people, having set a public red line, that here was an opportunity for the United States to demonstrate that this was a line, an international norm, that couldn't be crossed without consequence. And I think we could have staged a punitive strike, military strike, in reaction to that, which would not necessarily have led us down a slippery slope to war, but would have made an important point. So, you know, much as I sympathize with the broader concern that the president, I think President Obama rightly had, about not sliding into a large-scale military conflict in Syria, American intervention, I think in that instance we should have responded.
Back for just a moment to President Trump and Saudi Arabia. The president has noted that the Saudis are large consumers of U.S. military goods. Is there any reason to believe that a more full-throated condemnation of Khashoggi's murder would have caused the Saudis to take their business elsewhere, to buy their warplanes from some other country?
No, I mean, I think we have to be kind of cold-blooded about this, in the sense that, you know, it's not as if we need Saudi Arabia more than Saudi Arabia needs us. And the, you know, historic relationship we have has been a two-way street over time. And, you know, I think that's where, if you want to have a healthy relationship, you need to be honest about it. You know, some people are concerned that if you have those kind of sharp exchanges over differences, that it's going to undermine a relationship. I actually think it's an investment, at least over the longer term, in a healthier relationship, because indulging that kind of overreach, whether it's the murder of Jamal Khashoggi or it's overreach in the region, like in Yemen, is only going to produce a more brittle partner over time.
Hmm. All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. James is calling from Houston. Hi, James.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
I have to say the ambassador's one of the better NPR guests I've heard in some time. What I noticed was two themes in his discussion. One is being tethered to history, and the other one is a sense of leverage. So I would be interested in his opinion or his views on President Trump's Davos speech in January 2018, where he seemed to fairly clearly, I don't think he wrote the speech, but he seemed to fairly clearly state a relatively sound geopolitical view of world powers not entangled in agreements, not maybe even that engaged with each other as regularly as they have been, but coming together in times of need across the world and primarily taking care of themselves and building a strong society however they see fit. And then just for fun, I'd like to know if he's ever known of a president who would be more intuitively or personally engaged with the concept of leverage than the current president.
Hmm. Thanks for calling.
James, they're both really good questions, and thanks for both of them. I mean, on the first question, I remember that Davos speech, and on the face of it, I think it laid out an understandable and defensible strategy in the world. And I think the truth is, you know, whomever got elected in 2016 was going to have to readjust the terms, at least, of some of our relationships in the world, with NATO allies, because some of our NATO allies do need to bear more of the burden, with rivals like China, as I said before, where we did need to push back against predatory Chinese trade and investment practices. But I think the problem is that the words in that speech haven't been borne out in actions. Instead, what we've seen is a tendency to just be disdainful of the value of alliances and institutions altogether. You know, a sense that the United States gets its way in the world best through a kind of muscular unilateralism, and that, kind of like Gulliver and the Lilliputians, you know, we're tied down by alliances and institutions. So I guess my argument is, of course, in this post-Cold War era, you know, we need to reshape a lot of those institutions to fit new realities. But I think the practice, as opposed to those early words from this White House, has run in another and I think, you know, deeply concerning direction. In terms of presidents and leverage, I mean, you know, the president, through his own business experience, is, I'm sure, a connoisseur of leverage and how you do real estate deals in New York City or Atlantic City or someplace else. But I think, you know, leverage in international affairs, at least as I've experienced it, is not just about, you know, a bilateral exchange, you and somebody on the other side of the table. It's about multiplying your influence by building alliances, by, you know, having lots of company when you're making an argument. And I think that tends to get that kind of leverage, that concept of leverage tends to get lost on this president.
All right, back to the phones. This time we'll speak with Emmanuel in Austin. Hi, Emmanuel.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Thank you for this show. I listen to you guys all the time. I sorry I forgot your name, but the ambassador too, I didn't know him till I listened to him on this show, and I have to appreciate that he's been, he really amazed me in his knowledge about the foreign policy. I have to say that he's been right in most of them.
So glad to know. Do you have a question? Yeah, go right ahead.
Yeah, I have a question for him. What is his knowledge about the Biafran-Nigerian War of 1967, and what is happening in Nigeria today? How would he advise the Trump administration on what is happening in Nigeria today as to killing of Christians and the Islamization of Nigeria?
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thanks, Emmanuel. I mean, I remember reading about the Biafran conflict, you know, in the late 1960s. It was before my time as a diplomat. But I do think Nigeria is a part of Africa that the United States really needs to pay attention to, not only because of its sheer size, well over 200 million people, and its energy wealth and its weight in West Africa. But more broadly, I think, because the United States needs to pay more attention to Africa than we've done, to be fair, across administrations of both parties. Africa is a continent whose population is likely to double by the middle of this century, from 1 billion people to 2 billion people. And so if you think some of the challenges posed by a migration outflow from Africa in recent years have been serious, you know, you haven't seen anything yet. And unless we pay more attention with smart African leaderships to deal with unresolved regional conflicts, with problems of food, water, and health insecurity, with problems of poor governance, including, you know, in countries like Nigeria. So I think, you know, paying attention to Africa is hugely important. In the President George W. Bush administration, the president launched the PEPFAR initiative, which was aimed mainly in Africa at working to try to eradicate HIV/AIDS. And through that effort, working with lots of committed leaderships in Africa and civil society leaders, you know, Africa really is, like the rest of the world, on the brink, at least, of an AIDS-free generation. So that's an example, I think, of where smart American leadership coupled with courageous leadership in Africa can produce real results. And so whether it's in Nigeria or other parts of the continent, you know, I hope we pay more attention than we seem to be right now.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. When you lament the relative decline in the power of American diplomacy, you're careful to note that it didn't start with Donald Trump. When you talk about the State Department's strategic and operational drift, what do you mean?
Well, I think after the end of the Cold War, you know, when the United States really was the unrivaled player on the international landscape, we got a little bit complacent. It didn't seem that diplomacy mattered so much anymore because it seemed that we could get pretty much what we wanted on our own. And there was an understandable focus on, you know, what was in effect nation building at home. Which makes a lot of sense and certainly did at that time as well. But as a result, we cut the budget, you know, over the course of the 1990s for the State Department for Foreign Assistance quite a bit. In the late 1990s, we went for several years because of congressional pressures, not taking in any new members of the U.S. Foreign Service. Then came 9/11, the huge shock to all of us and to our system. And, you know, a tendency to further invest in military and intelligence tools and really to treat diplomacy, I think, as a kind of under-resourced afterthought. So that drift has been going on for a while, you know, much as individual secretaries of state and diplomats have tried to push back against it. But I think what's happened in the last couple of years is to vastly accelerate that drift and make the situation infinitely worse, not just in budget terms, not just in, you know, one statistic, you know, 50% drop in the number of young people applying to become U.S. Foreign Service officers, but in the kind of public disdain that comes from the president for, you know, the hard work of diplomacy and its professional practitioners. You know, the president, you know, was asked, I think, a little more than a year ago whether he was concerned about the historic number of senior vacancies in the State Department. And he said he wasn't because he was the only one who mattered. And that, you know, that reflects a view of diplomacy that I think is detached from the institutions that help make it run.
If the State Department has often found its influence overshadowed by that of the Pentagon, whose fault is that? Is it the Pentagon's fault, the State Department's fault, or the fault of the politicians that they work for?
Well, you know, it's a kind of combined effort. But I'll start with the self-criticism of the State Department. You know, individual diplomats can be incredibly innovative, courageous, entrepreneurial. But the State Department as an institution is rarely accused of being too agile or too full of initiative. And, you know, whereas the Pentagon is quite adroit at working the halls of Congress and making the argument for its budget, you know, sometimes we're not as active. We're a little bit more detached. We should be working more not just with the Congress, but with governors and mayors across the United States who see an increasing interest in trade and investment opportunities overseas and attracting foreign investment. Diplomats, I think, need to do a more effective job of making the argument that we always make. You know, smart foreign policy starts at home in a strong political and economic system, but also to make the argument that it ends at home, too, in better jobs and a healthier environment and more security. And I think a more active effort to do that can pay dividends in terms of, you know, reestablishing the priority of diplomacy.
I do think, I mean, I don't speak for all civilian Americans, but I think a lot of Americans don't conceive of the State Department's importance in international trade and the ways that that filters back to what happens on Main Street.
Yeah, I think that's true. And that's partly because I don't think we do as good a job as we should of making the case. You know, when we do a multi-billion dollar deal overseas, a big U.S. company, you know, oftentimes, I know this from my own experience as an ambassador overseas, you know, you spend a fair amount of your time trying to ensure a level playing field for U.S. companies, to try to help U.S. companies navigate what can be some really complicated, you know, business landscapes overseas. And so we ought to do more of a job when you have one of those deals and it directly creates, you know, thousands of jobs in different parts of the United States, whether it's a Boeing aircraft sale or, you know, some other, you know, kind of business deal. So you can help people understand that, you know, active diplomacy helped produce those kind of results and led to directly to positive economic results in the United States.
Ambassador William J. Burns is president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, former Deputy Secretary of State. During his diplomatic career, he also served as ambassador to Jordan and Russia. His new book is The Back Channel, a memoir of American diplomacy and the case for its renewal. Bill, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much for making time for us.
No, thanks so much to be with you and with your listeners. Thank you.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. Use your favorite podcast app and subscribe 9 times a week to the free Think podcast. If you want to know what we have planned for upcoming shows, check the website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.